everyone. Chat Cemetery is back. I am joined again by Katie Schaefer to discuss the 1990 It miniseries that aired on ABC. And there's a lot to discuss here because it was a two-parter that was released and it runs about 3 hours, give or take a few minutes here.
Yes, it is quite the time investment, I would say. 3 hours, 12 minutes, technically.
Yes, and then when they released it on DVD and Blu-ray, they actually were able to cut out 5 minutes because instead of having end credits and opening credits twice, they just cut that section out in the middle there. Oh, nice. And made it a little shorter for the rest of us. But the funny thing is, and I don't know if you knew this or not, Katie, but I was reading just online and in the Creepshow's book that this was actually intended to be a 7 to 8 hour miniseries.
I didn't know that, but that would probably have made it better. More time, I think.
And George Romero was supposed to be working on it as well. So you have all of these things that could have been, but were not, which, as you and I know very well, that's the case with a lot of Stephen King things. We get these adaptations that end up being in the works, I believe. One not too long before this was a late 80s version of Apt Pupil. And it had actually one of the same actors that was in this, Richard Mazur, who was supposed to be in that. So that never came to fruition. And then he got a role in this, which I thought was kind of funny. I was like, oh, okay.
Consolation prize.
Yeah. And I wouldn't necessarily say that this miniseries is bad. It's just one of those things where it was made for TV. So you have sort of this expectation when you hear TV movie or TV miniseries, especially in, you know, the 70s, 80s, and 90s, where you're like,
yeah,
okay, we'll see how this goes. And they did have a budget of $12 million, which is nothing to scoff at. Yeah.
Right.
And they did get some big names in this. So cast-wise, you have a lot of these kids who are relatively unknown, I would say. Seth Green has obviously gone on to become pretty famous. And yes, I would say he's the most successful of the kids. Jonathan Brandis at the time had done a few things and sadly later committed suicide, which is a little similar to what happened with, you know, River Phoenix from Stand By Me. So you have these similarities just between those two movies and those two stories in general that I think are pretty interesting. When you're working with kids, you kind of never know what's going to happen later on in their lives. We've seen a lot crash and burn, and you're just like, okay, where did they go? Some have since passed away, and others have gone on to become huge stars.
Yeah, I think it's always a challenge, and some people are great actors as children, and then they kind of lose it as they get older, and some, like Elle Fanning, go and just continue to grow their careers from childhood onward. And I think the only one of the kids that really made it, like you said, is Seth Green, and he's a great comedian, but I don't know how great an actor he is. He has what he does really well, but he doesn't have a wide range, we'll say. Because I like Seth Green, I got no problems with him, but he's not Elle Fanning. We'll say that.
Or Dakota Fanning. The Fannings got this thing down.
Yes. Those girls, they know what they're doing. But I think this movie definitely is hindered by the fact that it's made in the 90s. Or, well, it was made in the 80s, but came out in 1990.
Yeah.
It had a TV budget, and they were thinking of it as a TV instead of as a movie. And you can tell with how they wrote the script, how they shoot it, like the care and attention to detail is not there. There's so many times in this movie I was like, wait, what? But you just said, okay. Like, they didn't even cast a redhead as Bev as a child. And so the poem makes no sense. Like, so there's all of these little tiny things that show that it didn't get the care and consideration that, like, a big motion picture gets. But I think in the acting department, I agree. I think they did the best with the budget that they had. And I think the adults are all pretty decent. And the kids do their best. They're not distracting. They're fine in their roles. I think the only one that I don't care for is Jonathan Brandis, and that is entirely Brandis, not his performance in this. He does the best that Brandis could give at the time, I would say.
Plus, with the adults, you obviously have actors who are way more well-known. You have Richard Thomas, John Ritter, Annette O'Toole, Harry Anderson, Dennis Christopher, Tim Reed, and Richard Masur. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that correctly. I never know if I am. I just guess on half of these. But you have this ensemble cast that really thrives in the TV setting, I guess you could say, especially for the adults. Some of them had been in theatrical releases, but for the most part, you know, a lot of them were in the TV world. So it made sense to cast them. And you have a few other characters who pop up, like Henry Bowers, Audra. And I would say of those ones, Olivia Hussey might be the most well-known or had the most thriving career, I guess.
Yeah.
And we've seen a lot of times that when it comes to Stephen King adaptations, sometimes those movies are just what people become known for. And it's not to say that, you know, Sissy Spacek hasn't gone on to do other things and have other great roles. You know, I really enjoyed watching her in Castle Rock, another Stephen King property, and Bloodline, which was a Netflix original. So even though I hadn't seen her in a ton of things outside of Carrie, I was like, okay, there's clearly this respect that people have for her, even if some of us only know her really as Carrie up until, you know, we start seeing her pop up in other things.
Right, exactly. I think, and especially in the 90s, like, they wouldn't have had access to a whole lot of film actors because the worlds mm-hmm. of TV and film were so separate then. It was revolutionary at a certain point in TV when film actors started just being in TV shows. It's still kind of rare to make the transition back and forth and do it successfully where you're constantly going back and forth. I think Glenn Close has done it the best. This is one that comes to mind.
It's happening more and more now, too. You know, you have things like Big Little Lies and Homecoming, where Julia Roberts went over to the small screen. And it's funny because this was network TV. So that's also a very different ballgame than something like HBO or Amazon, Netflix, what have you. So we're seeing that more and more now just because of how the TV landscape has changed. And I think the downside with this being a TV miniseries on ABC in 1990 is the fact that you can't dive into this story as much as one would want because there are just so many things that you can't show on ABC. You know, there were big chunks of the book that were cut out because of just the graphic nature of them. And some of them, I don't blame them for leaving them out. You know, there are some moments in the book where you're like, did we need that? Are we sure?
Yep. It gets pretty intense, we shall say.
To say the least.
Yeah, exactly. It's one of his more crazy books when it comes to the sexuality in it, and the violence is just horrific. So horrific at times, and it's so often happening to children. And even that, you know, I still think that for what it is at the time, they still managed to do a decent job at hinting at the darker things that are happening without showing it on screen. They let your imagination do the work for you. But I did want to say Tim Curry is a film actor, and he was was, I would say, their big win.
Their one exception.
Yes. He's the reason this is as good as it is. If you didn't have a good Pennywise, then the whole thing was going to fall apart. And Tim Curry is iconic in this.
I totally agree. I think he's one of the reasons it stands up a little better than I was expecting it to. And obviously, with the 90s, like I mentioned, comes the story problems of it airing on network TV. And then you have the fact that just the effects aren't going to be quite as good because, again, it's on a TV budget. So
yes,
I think the story is really where this suffers. And it would be interesting to see, you know, what that 7 or 8 hour version would have looked like, especially with George Romero tied to it, because we've seen what happens when he teams up with Stephen King. And I would say that when he's working on something, you get a lot of effects that maybe other people wouldn't want to try. And obviously, some of that is due to Tom Savini's work and other people who are in that department. But it seems like George Romero just has such a deeper understanding of what Stephen King is going for with his books.
Yes. And I think he's, like you said, he's willing to try stuff because he's not afraid to see what happens and to kind of push the envelope and take the risk that maybe if we try to show this with this special effect, it won't work out and it'll take all this time and energy. Whereas Romero is willing to take that time and energy and do it because he thinks it will work. And he has the kind of mind that can put it all together in a way that makes sense for the viewer and his production budget.
Yeah. What they did accomplish with this miniseries, though, is that they took the core of the story and put that on the screen. And I feel like along with Tim Curry's Pennywise, because they hit those sort of major plot points, you're able to get a full story without getting the full story, if that makes sense.
Yes, I think so too. I think it, like in the end scene where the adults are dealing with the monster, and the deadlight, like all the boys get caught in the deadlights.
Right.
And then Bev goes and runs and does her thing. Like, it's totally possible that what they were experiencing in the deadlights is what's going on in the book. But we just don't see that. We just don't get to see that perspective. So I think they did try very hard to like, okay, well, can we leave space for those who have read the books to kind of fill in what's going on and not kind of just cut it off and say like, oh, well, this is what was happening while those guys were. We don't need to explain what was going on. We can just show this other part of the story.
Exactly. I think one of the things that helped a little too was the fact that they took the time to get the adults and the kids together, even though they had no scenes together in this. They wanted to make sure that they at least spent some time together, because I did feel like that when you were flipping back and forth between the kids and the adult versions of the kids, you know, you had this consistency at least.
Yes.
You felt like their personalities remained the same, you know, because you have all of these kids who have unique personalities, but they're all outsiders. And that's what brings them together and ultimately how they form the Losers Club, which is kind of the perfect name.
It is.
Because they're self-aware enough to know that they're the outsiders. You know, they don't really fit in with all of the other kids. And Henry Bowers is just a pain for everyone. Even the teachers are like, how many times are you going to be in this grade?
Yep. Could you just please move along, Henry? You're so unpleasant. Everything about him is just so unpleasant to deal with. Oh, yes. And I agree. They did a great job in having both the kids and the adults feel like the same person. And that's really challenging. It's really hard because without it looking like you're doing an imitation.
Right.
But I think it's almost like they worked out together. This is who this character is and this is how we should portray it. They do go a little over the top with it sometimes that I think is not the actors. I think this is a script thing or a production side where like all of the kids have some weird tic. Like Stan reaches up and grabs his earlobe and rubs it. And then you see adult Stan do it. And like there's tic like that for every single one of them. And it's just like, okay. So when Mike is making the calls in the beginning, you see them all do it. And you're like, oh my gosh, did we need to take it that far? But again, it's the 90s. They weren't as subtlety was not prized in these kinds of productions, I would say.
It was certainly overly dramatic TV acting at times.
Yes.
And again, a lot of that has to do with just the direction that they were going in with this. And I did notice that it had these aspects to where it would pull you out of the story and you're like, oh, I'm watching something that was a TV series. Because I would feel that way with all of those moments you mentioned when Mike calls them and they all start to remember. And then it's just like this light bulb going off and it's way too obvious that this light bulb is going off. And the music cues, I was like, oh my goodness, this story is just full of these moments where they're just like, yes, this is where the music goes.
Yes, they just, you know, took the most obvious bits and plugged it in. And it's, at times, it almost feels soap opera.
Yes, exactly.
Which is okay. Again, it feels very much of the era that it was made. But yet that and the sound mixing on this, like, I'm not one to usually notice a whole lot with that. But on this, it is so terrible. Anytime that there's like a silence on screen, you can hear that they've jacked up the sound in some way. And like the people's voices go at different levels, even if they're standing right next to each other or talking to each other. Like, they just made some really interesting choices with how they wanted to produce the sound in this movie.
I always think it's a bad thing when I actively notice the music, because then it means it did something that it probably shouldn't have done, and it took my attention away from what was going on. And that's not to say that I don't enjoy good soundtracks. Like, I love the music in Stranger Things, and I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that it's like, yes, I know the music is there, but it's not distracting me from what's going on the screen. It just amplifies what's going on the screen. And this, it was taking me out of it. So I was like, oh, okay, that's not great.
Yes, I see that too. I felt the same way. I was like, what is this music? Several times as I was watching it. And it's just so dramatic that it almost at times feels like satirical or like a way to make a scene comedic. But you know it's not supposed to be either one of those things. This is a genuine idea of what they think the music should be. And it's so obvious watching it that you're like, bad choice. Bad choice, my dude. Better no music in this scene than this music.
Yeah. What did you think about the fact that they left out so many of the subplots? Do you think that was a matter of not having enough time? Or do you think it was just all of the circumstances surrounding this, it being a TV miniseries? Because, you know, 3 hours is still a lot of time. You can pack a lot of story into 3 hours. And obviously with the remake, we're getting a much longer runtime because those are two theatrical releases that, if I'm not mistaken, both are over 2 hours long. And the new one, Chapter 2, is almost 3 hours long by itself.
Yep. Yep. I think it comes to like 5 hours is roughly how much you get, how much time you get on screen with the new one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I felt that some of it was okay. Like, cutting some of the side stories, they were pretty judicious in what they cut out. But I think there was some things that would have added more to the story, like knowing more about Mike. Mike always gets the short end of the stick when he's the kid in these movies, it seems. Like, knowing more about Mike and Richie would have been appreciated, I think, in this film and with this storyline. But it is very much that they chose to show most of the scenes of them together. Like, there's very few scenes in this movie, unless something is going on with Pennywise or before they're called back to Derry. After that happens, for the most of the runtime of the movie, they're all a group.
Yeah.
And I think that's why so much of those are cut out, because they have to be separate. And I think that movie thrives when they're all together and they're separate characters, but as they're a group, and it's the group actions that are what drive the film as opposed to the individuals within the group, I think, if that makes sense.
Yeah. If I'm not mistaken, they did change up a few things too, because I don't remember in the book Tom working with Bev at her company.
I think he's like a partner, but I don't remember him working with her. Like, he has something to do with it, but he's not like her agent, is my understanding. I don't remember. I'm actually reading it right now, but they haven't gotten into that part of it yet.
Okay. Something just felt a little different with that, because they were in the same room together in this, and I was like, I don't really remember that happening, because I swore she was at home and took the call from Mike.
Yes.
And then left, which they do show later, but I don't know if Mike actually called her company first.
No.
Because
I don't think so.
I mean, granted, the book's over 1,100 pages long, so
yeah.
And I'm a few books past that now, so details are a little blurry because there are so many in the book, so many details.
Yes. And yeah, no, we pick up with Bev as an adult for the first time at night when he calls, and she's okay. In bed with Tom. That's, and then that scene happens, and which is probably as TV close as you could get to that.
Yeah.
Story in the book, because it's pretty intense.
And then they made the choice to not have Tom go after her, which I thought was interesting, given that they stuck with the Audra storyline.
Right. I was confused by that as well. I was like, are we, what? After reading the book, because I think I watched this kind of in after I had been like 10, 15 years since I'd read the book. So I didn't really remember so much of it. But then now I've reread it recently and I rewatched it and all of that. And I was like, this is weird that you chose to do one story, but not the other, because it wouldn't have been that many scenes.
Right.
To have Tom come in and do this. And it would have added this interesting note of tension and showed more so how it can manipulate people outside of Derry,
mm-hmm.
and how well he can control them, because he has it with Henry Bowers, but then, you know, Tom didn't live in Derry and all that, but yet he's still able to be controlled once he comes to Derry. So I thought that would have added a lot more menace to Pennywise's actions, which they, because they don't have so much of that. They hint at it in this, that, you know, that the citizens of Derry are kind of subtly influenced all the time when mm-hmm. it is alive, but it does kind of make it feel like Bowers, he's only able to do it with Henry Bowers because of the connection they have from when Henry was a kid.
Yeah, it was a little odd because, like you said, it wouldn't have taken that many scenes. You didn't even have to necessarily show Tom leaving their house or apartment, whatever it was. You could have just right. shown him in Derry and we would have understood what was going on.
Right. Show him arriving in Derry, or right. like him checking in at a different hotel or something like that. Like, you could have added maybe two or three scenes at tops, because he never comes, like, he affects Audra and he's how Audra gets down there. And it would have been nice to see that part of it instead of just randomly like, oh, she's flying. And then somehow she got captured.
Yeah.
But I will say that scene where Bill picks up her purse, there's an amazing moment where he slips and falls, and he does the best fake fall ever. And I rewound it about four times just laughing at how, because you could totally see the mats on the floor and everything.
Yeah. TV budget.
Yep. I was delighted by it. Yeah, I think that was a missed opportunity. I think they really could have done something interesting with that, and they chose not to.
And obviously, even with the remake, there's some stuff that they're going to leave out, because again, this book is so long that even 5 hours, you're like, oh, but you didn't do this or this. And
oh yeah,
you know, at that point, it's kind of just nitpicking, but I feel like this version in particular left out so much. You're like, okay, we don't get, obviously, the Adrian Mellon scene. We don't get Tom coming to Derry. Thankfully, we don't get the weird orgy scene with
yep,
Beverly.
But we don't get the ritual of Chud,
right?
Which is just so awesome and so interesting in the book.
So it really does feel like they went with the Audra subplot. And I feel like they didn't even use it all that effectively, because they didn't go into the whole, oh, Audra looks like Bev thing, like they do in the book.
Right.
And I was like, okay, great. Audra came and now they're leaving. Like, I was not thrilled with that storyline.
Right. And they were already going into the sewer. She, in the book, acts as a catalyst that forces them to go right now. Right now they have to go deal with this situation instead of at a time of their choosing. And in this, it's like, oh, well, they're already going into it. And now Audra's here, but she doesn't. It has an effect at the end, you know, with the riding to beat the devil and all of that stuff that feels very strange in that movie. It makes sense in the book, but not so much in the film. But yeah, it feels misplaced that they include that part of the story, but not the Tom part of the story.
Especially since Audra's part has so little impact by the end of it. You know, obviously he wants to go after her and get her back, and they do. And I just think they were very limited, because even with the effects, you were like, okay, yeah, that's a big spider, but
oh yes,
nobody cares. Like, it doesn't look that bad. I mean, or that scary. I mean, it didn't look great from an effects standpoint. And even, you know, people who have worked on the movie have said that. And it's one of those things where your budget is what your budget is. And sure, sometimes you're able to go over budget, but I feel like when it comes to TV, they're a little more strict about that, because I know some movies like Jaws went quite a bit over budget, but yeah, they had to find a way to then get that money, you know, and ABC probably wasn't going to do that. And you have this one moment where all of the kids are seeing Pennywise, and I believe it's Eddie who sees him in the showers.
Yes.
And Pennywise goes down the drain, and you're like, oh, so very 90s.
Yes. I will say the part where he comes up and like rips open the thing, and it's that claymation look.
Yeah.
I thought that's good. But yeah, the leaving, when he does it and you just see his hand wave, I was like, he totally should have flipped Eddie off in that scene, in that moment. It would have been so much better. But ABC. So yeah. I'm honestly surprised that ABC made this. It feels very strange considering ABC is the most reserved. But maybe they weren't owned by Disney at that point, because now they are.
Yeah. I'm not sure when exactly that buyout happened, because Disney owns everything.
Everything ever. Yes, there's some moments that are real obvious where their budget was limited, and the end scene with that monster is definitely one of those. It was actually, I will say though, that this time around watching it, I was like, oh, it looks better than I remember. I just thought it looked like a spider. At least it's got a weird googly eye face.
Yeah.
Doesn't have like eight eyes or anything, just a weird face. But it is, it's very anticlimactic, I would say. The final scene is not satisfying as a viewer, and it never has been for me anytime I've watched it.
Yeah, some of the effects were fine though, given the time. You know, when you see Pennywise multiple times and he, you know, has the different hands and things like that, you can tell they put effort into these effects and did as good of a job as they could, basically. And, you know, Pennywise was actually kind of based off of Lon Chaney in The Phantom of the Opera.
Oh, okay.
But just stylized into a clown.
You're talking about their vision in this movie or King's original?
I think that was something that was just from the film, because it was...
Okay. That's how they approached it?
Yeah, that was how the special effects coordinator, Bart Mixon, approached it. And I don't really remember the exact phrasing of how King describes Pennywise in the book, because if you look at Tim Curry's Pennywise versus the Pennywise in the remake, you're like, these look drastically different. To me, Tim Curry's Pennywise has always looked like your average guy dressed up as a clown, which is totally fine. Yes. Because we know he kind of shape shifts and changes and has all of these things going on. And we see his teeth do that a lot, in particular in this. They like to do close-ups of his teeth, I noticed.
Yes. Yes, they do. Look at these special effects.
Yeah.
Look at them. Look how good they are. Because those actually do look pretty good, despite the fact that it somehow takes, you know, a full shot away and then a shot back for his teeth, for him to open his mouth. Like, he starts opening his mouth and then it looks at somebody and then it cuts back and now the teeth are all sharp and his mouth is fully opened. I always loved that. I was like, oh, this is an interesting, but you know, in between there, they're affixing him and makeuping and all that jazz.
Exactly. I was like, this is a lot. So many teeth, so many close-ups. Thank you.
Yes. They were really proud of how those teeth came out. And yeah, I think they went with a real simple design for Pennywise in this one. And I think that works to its advantage, because it's not over the top, not super stylized. So it allows clowns in general to just be scary, because he doesn't stand out that much from any other clown that you've seen.
And people are scared of clowns without the clowns necessarily needing to look scary.
Yes.
So yes, it works in that way, especially for that time period too. And I imagine the makeup took forever for that and everything. Oh, and you have the fact that a lot of the effects were practical. So then you're attaching all of these things and, you know, so much went into the effects, even if you can tell they haven't aged super, super well. But then, you know, the only digital thing they did was that drain scene, pretty much. And the term that they use for it is replacement animation, which is similar to stop motion animation, apparently. And I'm familiar with stop motion animation. I've seen what that looks like. But I was like, okay, I don't really know what replacement animation is, but we'll go with that since that's what they're saying it is.
Interesting. And that's, are you talking about in the scene where they are seeing the thing over the over their heads?
No, in the shower scene. Sorry.
Oh, in the shower scene. Yeah. Oh, yes. Okay. Yep, I know what you're talking about then. I can see how they, I think I can see what they're talking about with that. But yeah, I think the shower scene is pretty well done. And I think the practical effects hold up pretty well. Personally, the non, like with the shower heads all coming out and coming after Eddie, like all of that stuff feels, still feels good. Still feels like, okay, this is genuinely happening in this world. But some of the scenes with Pennywise where he does his more dramatic things, I agree. Those are, those are now you look at it and you're like, it didn't age well. As usual, most practical effects do age well because they're done in the real world.
Right.
And it's the digital effects where we can see the age on them that makes them look bad.
One thing I did notice too is when the deadlight scenes happen, you can tell they're kind of covering up some of the effects with that. Because you're like, oh, okay, yeah, that's a lot of light. That's probably more light than you needed to get your point across. But then you kind of understand why they're doing it because, you know, all of the kids fall to the ground. And that's probably another scene where they have the mats down.
Yes.
Because who wants to fall into a sewer drain? Real or fake?
Or like in the scene where Pennywise comes through the pipe when the kids have grabbed Stan and I think it's Belch.
Yeah.
Yeah, Belch dies and he gets sucked into the pipe. Like, it is incredibly bright in that scene, but then it casts everything else behind and around it into shadow. So it makes that is making up for whatever is going on around them to make that light work. And then when they pull Belch into the tube, that is that looks very well done, but also very oddly lit to cover up any, you know, doll parts that are
right.
Weird note about that guy. He is also, that actor also played the bully in A Neverending Story.
Okay. Fun
fact. That gets scared by Falcor at the end. So that guy, apparently all he did, just played bullies.
Some people know their roles.
He looks like a bully. I'm not going to lie.
And I know we've been pointing out a lot of the flaws with this, and a lot of it just has to do with how hard it is to adapt this story. Like I said, even the remake, there are things where you're like, oh, I kind of wish they would have done this or that. And look, I haven't seen chapter two yet. Hopefully by the time everyone is listening to this, I have gone and done that. But anytime you have a novel that is insanely long, you're going to have these moments where you can't adapt everything. You know, a really good example of that is the Harry Potter series, because over time, the books got longer and longer. So there were more things that couldn't make it into the movies necessarily. And those movies are fairly long. So you just sort of have to pick and choose. And especially on a TV budget, you really have to pick and choose. Yeah. And clearly they did that. But that's not to say I didn't enjoy watching this, because I did enjoy the experience of watching this and just getting to kind of revel in Tim Curry's Pennywise, even though he wasn't in it quite as much as I was hoping. But he was in it just enough to where every time he popped up on the screen, you were like, yes, more of this,
yes,
please.
Yes, I agree. I agree. It's such a great role. And he is by far and away the best actor in this film. Tim Curry is a phenomenal actor. And he brings his A game to this performance and really digs into being creepy as hell. And like even in the very first scene where he's getting that little girl through the laundry, you know, he's holding out the doll. And oh my God, you can tell right from there that like, oh, he's just unsettling That's his performance throughout this whole thing. When he, even when he's not being, you know, scary bite your face man, he's unsettling just to look at because of how he holds himself and his vague smile and the look in his eyes. Like, just everything about his performance is fascinating to watch. And I will say that I think that Skarsgård does something totally different in the new series, but it's something equally good. It's very much his own performance. And he said that when he was making it, that Tim Curry's performance was, he was scared that he wasn't going to be able to do anything different. Like, he had to find something totally unique because to him, Tim Curry was Pennywise and he had to differentiate himself from that. And I think that's how most people feel if you enjoy and have watched this movie.
Did you know he wasn't actually the first choice for the role?
Who was?
So they had Malcolm McDowell and Roddy McDowell, I guess. Their names their last names are literally one letter apart. So
oh my God.
You have these two who were choices before Tim Curry, but it's like, you know, Malcolm McDowell has played a villain more than once. You know, he definitely has that of appearance about him. And that's not to say he looks mean or anything like that, but Tim Curry also is the same way too. Like, if you see Tim Curry playing someone who isn't a bad guy, you're kind of like, huh, that's weird.
I mean, you're watching Clue, I guess, because it's my thought. I mean, yeah, he is very
true.
He gets pushed into that role a lot, but I think he is a man who can just explore a space so fully in a way that is entirely his own. I mean, Rocky Horror Picture Show would not be the movie it is today without Tim Curry as Dr. Frankenfurter. And he brings all of that energy to this. And even though it's just a TV movie based on a horror book, he still is just perfect in it. And I could see Roddy McDowell maybe. But Malcolm McDowell, like, all of his scariness resides in, like, him being menacing, him being creepily menacing, and that's not Pennywise. It doesn't feel like he would work. So I'm really glad that they didn't, and I love Malcolm McDowell, but I'm really glad they didn't choose him in the end.
I can't imagine it not being Tim Curry at this point. It's one of those things where, again, another iconic role, and he's had more than one of those, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And he comes from the theater world, which I think fuels a lot of his performance in this and a lot of his performances in general. You know,
yes.
Maybe I've just seen him in sort of the more villain kind of roles, which he's done a lot. So doesn't surprise me that I haven't seen everything he's done.
Yeah. Yes. And he is extravagant. He's an extravagant actor is what I like to think of when I think of Tim Curry. And he does a lot of voice acting. As he got older, he did lots and lots of voice acting.
Yeah.
And he's a British actor. So in the best tradition of British actors where, oh, you would like to pay me to do something? Of course I'll be in your movie. It's not, he is not of an American mindset. So he has so many credits to his name and he's fun to watch in pretty much anything he does.
Yeah, I'm going to backtrack here a little bit because we can't not talk about the catalyst for this entire story, which is Georgie's death, because
yes,
that yellow raincoat is also so iconic at this point, and the red balloon, you know, even though the balloons are other colors in this too, it's not strictly just red balloons, you know, he's got balloons of all colors going on there. And you have that opening scene where Bill is sick, so he gives Georgie this paper boat and, you know, they kind of lacquer it so it will not get totally destroyed in the water. And I know that based on when this took place, it was a very, very different time and kids went out by themselves all the time. But doing that in the rain when everyone else is pretty much inside seems like a bad move. And obviously, because it's a different time, that is something that is able to fly, basically, you know, that's something we can give a pass to because you're like, oh, okay, you know, late 50s in the book, you know, that event happens in 57 and then the Losers Club forms in 58.
Right.
You're like, okay. And I believe in this, it's in the 60s more so than the 50s. At least that's what Wikipedia says. But it doesn't really matter because those time periods are close enough to where things hadn't changed that much. So you let that pass, and then you're like, okay, this is a very traumatic event. And it felt like they didn't revisit Georgie quite as much as they do in the book. And again, you can't follow all of the subplots in 3 hours, so there is that. But
right.
You get these short moments where Bill sees Georgie, and then everyone's like, it's not real, it's not real. And then you kind of have all of these things that you can't see on the screen because they just don't have the technology to do them.
Right.
And I wouldn't say it takes away from the story, but at the same time, you're like, okay, Georgie's death was the catalyst for this. And then they're kind of like, oh, by the way, don't talk to Bill about this. So they kind of keep mentioning it without having to really talk about it.
Yes, I think so too. They kind of dance around it a little bit. And then I think there's only one or two instances where Pennywise uses George to haunt him.
Yeah.
But, and it is not played up nearly as much in the book. But I think that scene is very upsetting in the beginning.
Yeah.
And it's less so than in the new one where it is real graphic. This one, it is not nearly so much, but it's again one of those moments where they choose to leave it mostly to your imagination. Like, you don't really need to see the blood because you know that Georgie's arm was ripped off, and you can imagine in your head what that would look and feel like. And I think that first scene between Tim Curry and that kid is sets the tone for the rest of the movie.
Right.
And so I think it's well done. It's very well done, like the relationship between Georgie and Bill. And I think it's a good exploration, but I agree that it would have been nice if they had had a little more bringing Georgie into it as a reminder of how all of this began, especially once they're adults.
Yeah, I just felt like we definitely had to touch on that because you can't talk about the It miniseries without mentioning Georgie in that yellow raincoat and, you know, his paper boat.
Tony Dakota is who played Georgie.
And if I'm not mistaken, he kind of reprised his role in the short that came out not too long ago called Georgie. I haven't had a chance to check it out, but I know it was up on Fangoria and there's a teaser trailer on YouTube. So I will see what I can find for that and put all of that information in the show notes in case anyone else is interested in checking that out, because it directly ties to this version in particular.
Oh, it does. Oh, interesting. I will definitely have to watch that because it's crazy. That kid, he did about 3 years of acting and nothing since. And then except for this 7-minute short.
Yeah, I think it is one of those things where, you know, they just wanted to kind of continue what was started in this. And it says here that it's kind of a short alternate history sequel film to the miniseries.
Oh.
So that'll be interesting to check out eventually. It was one of those things where I saw it pop up, but I was probably, you know, like, knee deep in one of the books that I had to read. So it just slipped by me. And, you know, I definitely plan to get around to that. But another thing I want to bring up quickly is Eddie's death, because he kind of just falls over and then he's dead.
Yes, that's right. Oh, it's so poorly done.
I was like, wait, what killed him? Like, what's going on?
Yeah, exactly. Why is he dead now? What? Yeah, I felt that way too. He just kind of hit.
Yeah. I was like, he didn't even really hit his head or anything, did he? Like, what's going on?
Yep, and they don't. That is one scene that they really should have maybe pushed a little more and done a little more to show why he's dead.
Yeah.
Instead of he just falls over and, like, there's not a whole lot of blood or anything. And, I mean, we've seen him get picked up, but it doesn't feel like there's anything mortally wounding that happens to him, I think.
At first I was like, oh, they didn't kill Eddie. He just passed out. And I was like, wait, he's dead?
Yeah, he's dead. He dead. And you're like, oh, well, that's interesting. I didn't know you could die from nothing.
Yeah. I was like, all right, whatever. I'm going to let that go because I know he did die in the book. So They were trying to remain faithful within their restrictions.
Right, right. And they probably were like, it's not that much money, or it's not that important to the story. It's just, let's just show him dead. It'll be fine.
Exactly. Well, is there anything else you want to touch on? I know there's a lot, but also not a lot at the same time, oddly enough.
Right, right. So I know this is how it ends in the book, but what did you think of the ending that with Bill racing to beat the devil with Audra? Like, do you feel that was earned? Because it makes sense in the book because it calls back to something that happened when they were kids. Whereas in this, like, it's not as well explained.
It's not given to us within context, really. And
right.
I was kind of like, oh, okay, great. Good job.
It feels so tacked on, especially if you haven't read the book. Yeah. But, and the other thing I want to say is this one does feel, it does not suffer from what I call the Harry Potter syndrome, where, like you said, they're trying to cram so much in. And in Harry Potter, they opted to go with, well, we'll just include enough information that this is going to be entertaining, at least for the people who've read the book. But if you haven't read those books, then the movies make no sense. My mom has never read the books, and she watched them all with my niece and was like, I have no idea what is going on right now. And my mom is like a voracious reader and movie watcher and stuff. So this is not something that, it is something wrong with the movie if she can't follow along with what's going on. And I feel like they do a great job avoiding that in this. Like, this feels like a whole complete story. There's nothing missing. There's not a whole lot of nods to, you know, readers of the book. But because they don't have any of that, you can watch it and just experience it as a story and not feel like there is something going on that you're not catching on to because you haven't read the book. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I really liked that about it because the new one maybe doesn't do that as successfully, we'll say.
Yeah, I think just how they went about this, it made sense for what they were working with and what they felt they could properly adapt from the book. Because there are some things where if they had tried to do them, they clearly wouldn't have worked. You and I both agree that obviously Tom showing up in Derry would have worked because, you know, they put Audra in Derry. So why can't you put Tom there? But there are certain aspects of the story, especially effects wise, that just wouldn't have looked good. And we probably wouldn't have wanted those scenes anyway.
Right. Like the psychedelic mind fight that they get into with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would have, it's great in the book. It totally works. Would not have worked in a movie. Probably any movie.
It's one of those things where, kind of like comics, in comic books, you can draw anything you want. That doesn't mean it's going to be easy to put on your television screen or, you know, on a movie screen. So with a book, you can write whatever and describe it however you want. And that allows people to get this visual in their heads, but that visual can't necessarily live up to your expectations, especially in 1990.
Right. Yeah. And a TV budget. And I think there's aspects of that part of the story that, and several other parts of the story that they chose to cut out, that it only works when you're reading a book, because the book can expound on it in a way that would be incredibly tiresome for a movie to do. You don't want to watch that in a movie. But the book, you can read about it and you're like, oh, this is amazing. That's why I think it is my favorite of Stephen King's books. But yeah, and I like that. I thought they did a good job with adapting it in that way to make it feel like a whole cohesive story that makes sense. I mean, there's nothing super weird or out there in the fantasy aspect of this. Like, it feels coherent and cohesive, and that is something that it was challenging in adapting a book like this, or a book of this length in any genre.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I was impressed rewatching it this time about it, about that aspect of it.
Yeah. And again, I had a lot of fun watching this. I believe I ended up rating it a 3 out of 5. And obviously docking the 2 stars is because a lot of what they just didn't include that I felt could have been included for a TV series. And it's one of those things where I'm not going to really sit here and compare this to the remake because that's just so hard to do. Obviously, this accomplished something that it could only accomplish in 1990, whereas the remake coming out in 2017 for the first one and this year, 2019 for the second one, that's such a big gap that you can't really be like, oh, well, you know, they put this scene in when that scene wouldn't have been possible to put in 1990.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you can, if you want to compare them, it's looking at them as adaptations is kind of the only way I can think of to do it. I mean, I will say that this movie does not have the best script.
Right.
And the plot is good, but the script is not. And like some of the acting is very overdone and over everything. But
like you said, it's soap opera-y at times.
It is. Yes. And I think, so you can talk about that, but I don't think that's a fair comparison to make in regards to the new one, because the new one has some of the best actors working today in it.
And it's so, a theatrical release versus TV.
Right. That had a budget of like 80 million, I think, for the first one or something.
Yeah. And probably a lot more for the second one.
Right, right, with a great director and blah, blah, blah. So yeah, I agree. Those parts are not comparable. I think it's really only in how the technical aspects of how they chose to do the adaptation. And you kind of have to make allowances for, like you said, well, you really could not have shown that in 1990 in a movie at all because CGI, it was not a thing then, or it was in its infancy stages at least. And so it's a difficult thing. And I think this one does some things better. I have seen It Chapter Two, and I think this one does some things much better than the new ones. But I think the new one is still a thing of its own.
Yeah. And that's the nice thing with these two. It's like, you know, when they did the Pet Sematary remake, there were aspects of that I liked more than the original. But then there are some things that the original just did so well that you're like, you know what? These are each their own thing, and it's okay to like both of them for different reasons.
Right. And in these instances, like remaking like It and Pet Sematary and stuff, I am not of the mindset of like, it's not the same thing as remaking, say, RoboCop.
Yeah.
You know, like these are books and it's been long enough now that I think it's interesting to see how our culture reinterprets a story with so much time difference. So I think, and the culture is totally changed.
Yeah. If I'm not mistaken, Pennywise came back every 27 years in the book.
Yes.
Okay. So between 1990 and 2017, Pennywise came back 27 years later.
Right.
That was a smart move on their part. I don't know if they planned it that way, but I hope they did.
I hope so, too. I think it's probably just a good coincidence.
Wonderful coincidence.
Yes. And I think it works very well, you know, when you look at it that way. Because it's like, oh, well, this is a new and interesting adaptation that's being done in an entirely different way. And so it's fun to see the variances between the book, this miniseries, and the new duology movies. I just think it's we're lucky to live in a time when we get so much Stephen King.
Which is all the time.
Yeah. Let's see. That time has been since Carrie came out, because I think there's roughly a movie a year, every year since then.
Yeah. And we have two
there's
this year.
There's only a couple.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, and some years we got more. So it's very interesting to me to live in this time. And I will be sad when we're no longer living in this time, because King's stuff has so much breadth for adaptation.
Yeah. So who knows when this podcast will have an end date, but I'm okay with that.
Right. I am too.
Well, Katie, thank you so much for joining me to talk about this. It's definitely been fun diving into it and sort of pulling it apart. You know, I do like to point out the good things, but I think this one had a lot all around to discuss.
I agree.
Before we go, I want to quickly let you all know about our Patreon. You can support both of my podcasts in general for $1 a month, and there is now a $2 a month tier, and I will send you a Chat Sematary sticker. So those are just a couple ways you can support this podcast if you enjoy it. And as always, you can find us at Chat Sematary on Twitter and Instagram. And thank you all for listening. I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.